as an introduction to a continued study in this book, which will last for some time. Okay? We said relative to this introduction that there is a key phrase that runs throughout the book at least 10 times, and the outline is based upon the concept of the generations of. This word for generation is the word toledot. Okay? Now, that word, generations, toledot, means birth, or the idea of production. So, I translating that into a 20th century vernacular would be the idea of family history. Okay? 10 times in the book of Genesis, you have this statement. So when you put that all together, it means that Moses, in writing the book of Genesis, is trying to give us some concept of family history. And the first one that he approached was somewhat the production, the family history of the heavens and the earth, the generations of the heavens and earth. I don't want to repeat this too much because this is mentioned in chapter 2. We had this last week. This is sort of by way of review, 2-4. And this actually covers chapter 1-1 through 4-26. The second use of this statement was of Adam, the generations of Adam. We found the statement in 5-1, and that section covers 5-1 through 6-8. The third use of the generations were the generations of Noah. We found that statement in 6-9, and that section runs from 6-9 through 9-29. Did I skip one? No, that's right, generations of Noah, point 4. The fourth use were the generations of the sons of Noah. And that statement was found in 10:1. And the passage that concerns the sons of Noah, where they settled and so on, runs from 10:1 through 11:9. Now, this is a very important paragraph, or several paragraphs, because it gives to us some idea of where the nations, or from whom the nations sprang. So under this you have three sons of Noah. We mentioned Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we have the settlement of the nations. So when we get on this passage, we'll be talking about these various languages and these various ethnic relationships through which the nation states were settled. He's not living now, but there was a man who was probably the most famous, most productive of all the archaeologists that America ever produced. His name was James Foxtel Albright, and he taught at Johns Hopkins University. And when Albright first began his work, he was a complete agnostic. He didn't believe that you could prove that there was a God, or that there was such a thing as divine revelation. Well, Albright lived to be a very, very old man, into his 90s. And he taught at Johns Hopkins all that time. And when you compare the writings of his old age to the writings of when he was younger, you'd almost swear he had become a believer. Whether he had or not, I don't know. That's in the hands of God. But Albright says about Genesis 10 and 11, that this is the most accurate, the most authoritative, the most concise, the most precise statement of the origin of the nations known to man. Its accuracy, from his point of view, was unimpeachable. Very exciting story about that man. Anyhow, we're going to dwell some time when we get to that chapter. The fifth use of the statements of Toledoth refers to the generations of Shem. Okay? So you have a genealogy in chapter 11. This is found in chapter 11:10, and the context runs from 11:10 through 26. Okay. Now you have 10 generations. You remove from Shem, and you move down to Terah, and you have something like 9 generations. It's 10 generations to Abraham, and it's really Abraham that is sort of the focal point of the book of Genesis. He is the core person that's in view. So we got to this point last week, the generations of Terah. Okay? We open your Bibles to 11 and verse 27. Genesis 11 and verse 27. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. So we have Terah begetting 3 sons. Abram, who becomes Abraham after God renames him. Excuse me. Nahor and Haran. Okay? Now, at least 2 things or 3 things that I want to point out about this next section. This section is going to run from chapter 11, verse 27, all the way to 25:11. And the focal point of all of that is going to be on this man, Abraham. Abraham becomes a key figure of the Old Testament. Now, this becomes quite significant in New Testament times because there is no other figure of the Old Testament that's mentioned as often as Abraham in the New. In fact, I guess we have to keep it in Old Testament figures. Among the Old Testament figures, there's nobody. Well, I said that. I'm trying to get Jesus involved in it. I guess the Apostle Paul is mentioned as many times as Jesus, but he's a New Testament figure. Jesus is mentioned more than any person in the New Testament, but of the Old Testament figures, Abraham is mentioned more than any other. This is because he is the how to be saved man. In other words, he illustrates very concisely for us how to be saved. If you look at Romans chapter 4, people were saved in the Old Testament just like they're saved in the New Testament. They are saved by a work of grace of God, and this involves faith on their part. They respond to God's provision of righteousness. And Abraham becomes illustrative of that. And in Romans 4, verse 1, we read, "What shall we say then that Abraham, our father, as pertaining to the flesh, hath found? For if Abraham were justified," where justified simply means to be made righteous, "if he were made righteous by works, then he had whereof to boast or to glory. But God has designed a plan where no man were able to do that for him." So Paul appeals to the Scripture, Romans 4:3. "For what does the Scripture say? Abraham believed God, and what it was counted, or it was reckoned, or it was put down to his account for righteousness. In other words, Abraham exercised faith, and that faith was directed towards something. In this case, it was God's promise of salvation. Now, that same thing happens to you and me. So Abraham becomes illustrative. We exercise great faith in what God has promised that he has accomplished in the work of Jesus Christ, and this equals salvation. And what Paul is trying to point out in the fourth chapter of Romans is that faith involves no work. This faith means rest, not effort or work. Now that concept of salvation began in the garden with the fall of Adam, and it becomes highly illustrated in the person of Abraham. So Abraham is a key figure, and a great portion of the Old Testament is devoted to him and to his name. Now there's another concept here. Abraham's experience runs something like this. By the way, one of the exciting things about Genesis, it accounts for these origins, and all of the men that are named, or most of the men that are named, were great heroes to the Jewish people. They were their patriarchs. So that you will find them repeating, you know, we are of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. One of the exciting things about Genesis is that it doesn't only tell us good things about these men, it tells us some of the very wicked things that they did. For example, Abraham went down into Egypt and in view of a famine in the land, and in Egypt Pharaoh took a liking to his wife, and Abraham very conveniently said, well, his life was at stake. He felt that Pharaoh might get mad at him if he wasn't compatible to the situation. So he said, well, she's my half-sister. Pretty nice guy. Jacob, or Judah, got involved with his daughter-in-law sexually. Had offspring from her. Some very, very wicked things told about these patriarchs. Well, Abraham's experience can be summarized something like this. He would have promise, and then after the promise would come, there would be the pressure. Now, if he bought the promise, see, there would then be a response, and then there would be a result. Sort of a causal-effect relationship. Pressure came through circumstance. So if he bought the promise, you buy the promise, you got good results. If you reject the promise, the net effect was disaster, collapse. So he becomes illustrative of the Christian's experience, the Christian's walk in this world. God gives us promise. Buy the promise, good results. React to the promise negatively, bad results, collapse. Abraham is a key figure in the Old Testament. Let me point out one more thing, the generations. The generations. You notice that he doesn't begin with Abraham, he begins with Terah. So let's repeat the concept. The generations came this way, Terah. And over here, Abram, who is Abraham. Excuse me. Terah, Nahor, Haran. Okay. Now, through Abram is going to come Isaac. And all of these are going to be named in this section. We're trying to get the big picture. I hope you've caught that by now. We're trying to get our purpose in this is overview. Okay. Now, Isaac is part of the promise concept. See, this is the son of promise. Now, how are we to respond to the promise? How? Time for morning exercises? How are we to respond to God's promise? What is the right response? You buy the promise. What does that mean? Faith? Rest. Yeah, you rest. And the pressure comes and you say, hey, here's the promise of God for us in this situation. Let's rest in the promise. Which means you don't have much capacity to meet the need. So here's Abraham, and God comes to him in Ur of the Chaldees, and he's young and strong. And he has a wife. God says, get thee out of this country into the land that I will show you, and I will bless you. I will make of you a great nation. I will multiply thy seed. Thy seed shall be as the stars of the heaven and the sand of the seashore. And Abraham says, I buy it. Packs up, says to Sarah, get things ready. Get the van ready. Throw what we have into it, sell the rest, and let's head north around Fertile Crescent. Gets on Highway 25 out of Ur, going north. Goes up to Haran, over to Carchemish, drives around, gets down to the Palestinian area. Gets out of the van, walks over on a hill, looks around, says, boy, this looks like the place. God says, this is it. This is yours. Look as far to the north as you can go. Look as far. I'm going to give you all of that. Oh, I'm going to multiply your seed. I'm going to make them as the stars of heaven, as the sand of the sea. Abraham says, great. Pitches a tent. Well, a few other things happen, a few negative things. God has to teach him a few things.
He's moving along the way, and he's 89 years old. He's 89 years old. That's pretty old. Anybody here 89? Anybody here feel 89? I do. I played softball for 2.5 hours on Friday. What a dummy. He's 89. He says to Sarah, Sarah, I'm 89. You're 79. We don't even have any kids yet. Pressure, see? So he began to question the promise. So he says, pretty soon I'm going to be too old to have kids, Sarah. What do you think we should do? So she gives him Hagar. And dummy Abraham follows human viewpoint, which was a Nuzu custom. A Nuzu custom was that a handmaid could bear children to the master of the house, and they would be considered his offspring. So rather than rely on the promise, he now rejected the promise at this age. He began to waver. And disaster set in because Ishmael was born. Okay? Now, to show the respect that God has for Ishmael, it wasn't Ishmael's fault, he includes the generations of Ishmael. That's going to be our next generation. Ishmael had every chance of being saved, just like Isaac did. The only issue in these generation lines is the issue of where Messiah is going to come from. Abram and Sarah bought a human viewpoint custom relative to having kids and disaster. Ishmael becomes the progenitor of the Arab nations, which we shall see in just a few minutes. Okay? Well, Isaac then has two sons. One is Jacob, and one is, these are twin brothers, one is Esau. Okay, now which one was the older? Esau. Esau was the older. So he should have inherited the birthright. So included in the story of Jacob, or in the story of Genesis, is the story of how Jacob got the birthright. Mother got into the act. Mother had to help manipulate the situation. Mothers always have to help God out. They feel the divine calling to sort of control things. They're the arrangers of things. If you're single in this church, you're in a very dangerous situation, because all of the mothers and wives in this congregation make matches for you. You have to be very careful about them. You'll find them inviting you over to dinner, and all of a sudden there's somebody else there. Oh, I wanted you to meet this person. Isn't it a coincidence that they showed up for dinner today? Just bear along with them. They mean well. I mean, they're nice people. Mother decides she better help God out. Well, that's a screwed up story. We'll talk about that when we get to it. The story of the Bible is a story of the sovereignty of God showing how he works out his plans despite the stupidity of human beings. And as you read the Bible, you can come to at least one conclusion: that man in his wisdom is finite, but in his stupidity he's infinite. Doesn't even have enough sense to trust God. And that's the whole story of the Bible. It's there. It's all over the pages. I said a few things about Jacob one time, and we had somebody here, and they said I was anti-Semitic. And it's all over the Bible. It's in the Bible. Okay. We're going to have a lineage of Jacob when we get down to the end of the book. He's the 10th one, but he's prolific. He is prolific. He has 12 boys. Pretty good start. But the emphasis of the 12 is going to be on Judah, because this is going to be the lineage of Messiah. And this is what the book of Genesis is concerned about. It tells us how all of this got started, and what a key figure Abraham is in this section, the generations of Abraham. Okay. The concept here in the sons of Abraham is that God will expand his promises. He will take the promises that he gave to Abraham, and he will give them to each one of these sons. And the concept is that Ishmael is not in the line. Esau is not in the line. It has nothing to do with their salvation. It has only to do with the concept that they are not in the lineage of Messiah. So as you move through the book, through the generations of Terah, God is expanding his promises, particularly the promise of messianic blessing, and preserving messianic lineage. See? The line through which Messiah will come. It will not be through Ishmael. It will be through Isaac. Isaac has two sons. It will not be through Esau. It will be through Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons. Messiah will not come through Simeon, Levi, Naphtali, etc., 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 but through Judah. See? Okay. The seventh use of the term Toledoth, the literary outline of Genesis, relates to Ishmael. Point seven, the generations of Ishmael. Mentioned in Genesis 25:12. And the context of Ishmael runs from Genesis 25:12, picks up with the death of Abraham, and runs through 25:18. Okay, so let's look at Genesis 25 and verse 12. Thank you. Now these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar, the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bare to Abraham. These are their names according to their generations, the firstborn of Ishmael, Nebaioth, and so on. Now, Ishmael is not overly important in the Messianic line, so he's going to be polished off shortly here. It's only about 7 verses. But the idea of including him is that out of Ishmael comes 12 Arab nations. And these people are going to be very hostile people. If you go back to the 17th chapter, I think that's the place I want. Yeah, go back to the 17th chapter. Well, go back to 16. Compare 16, verse 11. This is the angel of the Lord speaking to Hagar after she was turned out of her house. And the angel of the Lord said unto Hagar, Behold, thou art with child, and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard of thy affliction. And he will be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And the idea there is that of the descendants of Ishmael, there is going to be great mistrust among these people. It's going to be very hard for these Arabic nations to get together on anything. They're going to be kind of wild in their attitudes. Over in 17 and verse 20, you have the Lord's prophecy about the number of nations that will come out of Ishmael. And as for Ishmael, 17:20, Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful, and I will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant of promise, will I establish with Isaac, which Sarai shall bear to thee at this set time in the next year. Okay? So that takes us to this next person. It can't be 9:30. It's impossible. Oh. Generations of Isaac. Okay? Now this statement we have in 25:19, immediately following Ishmael. And Isaac is not a... We have a long context till the next statement about generations, but not a lot of information is given on Isaac. Most of it has to do with his son Jacob. But this runs from 25:19 through 35:29, all the way through chapter 39. And what you have in the midst of that is the story mainly of Isaac's two children. Isaac begets Esau and Jacob, twin brothers. Okay. The issue is over the covenant. And the covenant is going to be renewed with Isaac in one chapter and then with Jacob in another. That is, this is going to be the one through whom the promise comes, not Esau. I'd like to get more involved in this, and I'll have to hold it till later. Okay, trying to get the overview now. The main generations of Isaac, key generations, Esau, Jacob. Okay? Point nine. God is very generous in this book. Even though Esau is not in view, the generations of Esau are in view because they also become hostile to Israel. This statement is found in Genesis 36:1, and this context of the generations runs from 36:1 through 8, and we have to, through 37. I'm sorry, I should just put 1 through 37, verse 1. Now, Edom Or Esau marries a Canaanite. He gets hacked at his father and at his family. And in complete disobedience to God, he marries a Canaanite. A Canaanite woman. And that intermarriage was forbidden to these descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when he does this, he's like the teenage rebel. Gets mad at his parents, goes out, marries a Canaanite, moves out of the house, and moves down to Edom. And from Esau and this Canaanite union comes the Edomites, who become the enemies of Israel. The Edomites live south of Palestine, and when Israel comes out of Egypt to come back, we have the statement, and the context will run from Genesis chapter 37. That is, we are told of his generations in 37:2 through 50 and verse 26. Okay. When he was born, Esau was born first, and Jacob is born grabbing onto his heel. That must have been an interesting delivery. I imagine they talked about that for weeks afterward. And from that birth, he gets his name, Jacob, which means grasper or heel grabber. And he was a grasper. And he was very successful at it. Mama got involved again in the act and had him sent over to his Uncle Laban's place. And Uncle Laban was a schemer and a rascal and a grasper too, only Jacob was more capable of grasping. And Jacob leaves out of Laban's house with two of his daughters, two of his handmaids, 12 kids, sheep, goats, cattle, wealthy. And in fact, Laban was glad to get rid of him, for it was all over with. He was so successful. Okay? Generations, however, is the concern. So here we have Jacob. And he takes on two wives, not necessarily by his choice, but because of this uncle Laban, who was such a grasper. And the first one was Leah. Okay? And Leah, whom he didn't like so much, he liked Rachel more, but Leah was very productive with children. So, out of Leah comes Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. If Jacob would have had his choice where Messiah would have come from, it would have been through Rachel. He liked Rachel better than Leah, but that didn't happen. Rachel almost remained barren all of her life, but she did have Benjamin and Joseph, very late in their marriage. In fact, these are the two younger of all of these 12 kids. So again, human viewpoint entered the act. When Rachel couldn't have children and saw Leah having so many, she got jealous and she says, "Why don't you take my handmaid, Bilhah, and have a few children by Bilhah?" So he's a very obliging husband. Says, "Sounds like a good deal to me." And Bilhah produces Dan and Naphtali. And, of course, then Leah had to get into the act with Zilpah, her handmaid, and Zilpah produced Gad and Asher. And you have the 12 tribes of Israel. See? These become the fathers, or the 12 patriarchs of the 12 tribes. Now, in the course of the story, there is a focus on Joseph. Here is the messianic line, messianic lineage, which is in view in the book. But the story focuses on Joseph because it is through Joseph that these 12 sons and their families go down into Egypt at the end of the book. So a good portion of the latter part of the book focuses on this person of Joseph. so that when the book of Exodus opens up, we know why we're there. Okay? Any questions on these statements relative to the overview of this book, the literary structure? And apparently Moses is following that literary structure. And it looks like it would make much better sense if when the one who divided the book in the 12th century A.D. would have divided it around that literary structure and made the divisions that way, see? It's very apparent that Moses is following that line. Questions? Okay, what I'd like to do in closing is to give you a structural overview of Genesis in sort of a delineating chart, a lineage chart, okay? Structure of Genesis. And the concept is something like genealogical. Only we're interested a little bit more than that. All of you younger persons know what genealogical means? That means where you got your genes. Did you get them from Abraham, or did you get them from Shem, Ham, or Japheth? Where'd you get your genes? That's the idea. Okay? Now, we start off the book with terrestrial creation. Terrestrial creation. What's the terra? Terra and the firma, the earth. Okay? We're not interested in angelic beings when we're looking at terrestrial creation. In fact, nothing is said about angelic creation in the book of Genesis except that it's subsumed under Genesis 2:1, where it says, "And in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth and all the hosts of them." That is, the angels were created in that time, in those 6 days, but they're not in view. So we're interested in terrestrial creation as opposed to angelic or non-terrestrial creation. The book of Genesis does not concern itself with that. Okay? Now, terrestrial creation is broken into two areas. Okay? All the 12 years old understand what we mean when we mean terrestrial. We mean that of the earth, not that of outer space, wherever that is, if there is such a thing, since we live in an expanding universe with billions and billions and billions and billions of stars and billions of suns within the Milky Way itself. So beyond us. We're talking about that which we know about, terrestrial creation. Okay? That is divided into two areas. First one comes over here, and it is non-reproducing. Non-reproducing. Okay, by that we mean it is non-cellular. A rock does not have cells. A rock may have protons and neutrons and electrons and atoms, but it doesn't have cells. Okay? So, this is Earth, rock, inanimate material. Now, somebody that's here that is a geologist, he might want to wrestle with that term inanimate. No, he wouldn't. He'd probably agree to it. He would have to say that oil and that such thing came from the decay of animate material. He has a little struggle with how that happened. Now, as opposed to the non-producing or the non-cellular, we have the reproducing creation. Reproducing creation. This would be cellular. Okay? Animate life is made up of cells. Okay, animate material that reproduces itself.
Now, that divides. This does not divide, but this divides. From divine viewpoint, there are two categories of reproducing or cellular creation. There is, first of all, on this side, the living. Now, the living would that be that which has a soul. So the Bible will say, man became a living soul. It will say about animal life, that animals have a nefesh hayah. They have a soul. And we'll talk about what that means when we get to it. Now, as opposed to that, there is the non-living in the sense of no soul. I'm sorry, ladies, but from the biblical point of view, your plants do not have a soul. They may respond very nicely to your gentle strokes or to your soothing them, speaking nicely. And that's really true. You live in a hostile house, all the plants go. There's animosity in the home, the plants feel it. Okay? And the concept in the Bible is that within the plant kingdom, within the plant world, we have many kinds. That is, there are many family trees. Many kinds. Many family trees. The family trees, however, produce after their own kind. An orange tree doesn't produce apples. A walnut tree doesn't produce plums. Never has, never will. If a tree can be, come on, you biologists, if a tree can be cross-pollinated, that means it's of the same kind, that's all. Okay? So, within the non-living concept of Genesis, the structure of creation, many plants, many family kinds. But within the living, we break down again. Okay? We have to break down two ways. How's the chart coming? Is your page long enough? Over here we have man. Over here we have animals. Animals are said to have a nefesh hayah, a living soul. Men are said to have a nefesh hayah. But the difference between man and animals is that man is in the image of God. That is, he is like God in certain respects. Okay? Where the animals, there is no image of God. Now, under the concept of animals, again, like the plants, we have many kinds, many family trees. Okay? But under man, we only have one kind. There is only one tree. One family tree. Now, the other day, they tried to transplant the heart of a baboon into the heart of, take place, the heart of a man. That may be possible, and that may even work out. I don't know. I don't want to criticize that. But I just would lay 10 to 1, 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1. I'm a gambler at heart. I bet you there's a lot of Homo sapiens that have tried to have sexual intercourse with apes. I wouldn't put that past the human race at all. But they've never been able to have any production out of it. Because these two trees don't mix. And unfortunately, in your human viewpoint education today, you have them all mixed up. So that if you follow human viewpoint education, you don't know who you are or what you are or where you are in this thing of God's plan. The only way you're going to know is if you believe the Bible. Are you some higher form of an animal? Something progressing through happenstance and time and chance? You are progressing toward something that's going to be beautiful in the end. You're not so good now, but you're going to be nice in the end.
All it takes is time and chance. You really believe that? You do if you believe in evolution. And it's sort of, it's very optimistic. You know, evolution is really optimistic. You know, we're really getting better and better. We started off back here as an animal flopping around, but we're moving in the right direction, and we're all going to come out okay. Just stay with the program. No concept like that in the Bible. Only one kind in terms of man, only one family tree, everybody coming out of that same family tree, no mixing of the trees. Okay? Now, the story of Genesis is the story of that, the lineage that moves from Adam, who is the source, to Seth, his son, to Noah, with 10 generations in between. From Noah to Shem, from Shem to Abraham, with 10 generations in between, and from Abraham to Isaac, and from Isaac to Jacob, and from Jacob to Judah. And from Judah, then, this is where the family tree ends in Genesis, but Messiah comes through that family tree. Okay? And that is sort of the purpose of the book of Genesis. Next week, we'll start with Genesis 1:1 in our exegesis of this study. Are there any questions I could answer hurriedly? Went 4 minutes over. It's not too bad for me. Questions? Okay, next week we begin with Genesis 1:1. Shall we close in prayer? Again, we thank you, our Father, for every person in this room. We thank you for the younger persons. We pray that you'll help us to be communicative with each other relative to this material, encourage people to ask questions, and help us that we might grow in grace and understanding of you and your plan and of the glory of Jesus Christ. We ask it in his name. Amen.